Welcome to the Morning Glory Project, Stories of Determination. I'm your host, Betsy Graziani Fassbender. Like in nature, we see determined flowers and vines clinging to life and seeking light, so are Morning Glory people. And in this podcast, I'll interview writers, activists, artists, entrepreneurs, survivors and thrivers, and trailblazers of all kinds. These are folks that have been determined to get over, under, around, and through the obstacles that face them, or to seize the opportunities that come before them. I find these people inspiring and amazing. I know you will too. I'm so happy to welcome to the Morning Glory Project, Julie Barton. Julie is the New York Times bestselling author of Dog Medicine, How My Dog Saved Me From Myself. The memoir was initially published by a micropress called Think Piece Publishing in 2015. It was then bought by Penguin Books and republished in 2016. Dog Medicine has now been translated into 8 languages and is available worldwide. Dog Medicine was the recipient of a Silver Nautilus Award for its exceptional literary contribution to spiritual growth, high-level wellness, and positive social change. Julie has 2 master's degrees that she got in an effort to justify leaving a marketing job where she spent all day in a cubicle, but made good money. She's originally from Ohio and dreams of returning to the Buckeye State someday to buy a big white farmhouse with a red barn that she could convert into an animal shelter. Until then, she lives in the East Bay of San Francisco with her husband, 2 daughters, 2 dogs, 1 cat, 1 guinea pig, and she's currently teaching and working on her 2nd book, also a memoir. Julie, welcome to the Morning Glory Project. I'm so glad you could join us.
Thank you so much for having me, Betsy.
So Julie, your book is so beautifully rendered. It describes... On the front of the book is this beautiful picture of your amazing dog, Bunker, whom everyone in the pages will fall in love with, of course. And maybe you can tell us a bit about the events that brought Bunker to you, and then what caused you to write the book?
Yeah. Well, I grew up feeling more connected to animals in the natural world than people. I grew up in kind of rural Ohio and a very loving but troubled family. And getting the dog, you know, it followed a long series of events that really turned into a long, slow, sad downward spiral for me. I was 22 and I had gone to college and I did well and I graduated and I moved to New York City because I wanted to write, and that's where I thought you were supposed to go. And
All writers have to go to New York City. Is that the rule?
Live in New York and work in like cafes with rain dripping down the windows. And so I did that, and you know, I moved there with no job, very little money, and managed to live for a year on my own. My parents didn't give me any money to support myself, and I did it. But the process of doing that was very challenging, but the thing that really got me was this thing I didn't know I was doing, which was I just was constantly beating myself up in my mind. Everything I did was wrong or bad or stupid. Therefore, everyone around me was wrong or bad or stupid. And, you know, it just became darker and darker and darker. And in this process of this year in New York, I broke up with this boy that I thought was, you know, the love of my life. And, you know, I lost friends and things just started to kind of fall apart around me. Finally, one day I went to work and I came home. And when I came home, I could just feel like, I think I describe it in the book as a marionette with 2 snap strings, or, you know, or just like I was like a robot losing power. And I was making dinner, and I put water on my little junky stove in my tiny little 2-foot kitchen in an apartment in New York. And I just collapsed on the floor and I started weeping. And I was really, truly in and out of consciousness. And I don't know what a nervous breakdown is. I don't really know how you define that. But this was a breakdown that I had no control over what was happening. I just had to let it out. I just had to give up. And I just remember thinking to myself, just give up, just let go. You have to let go, because holding on had become excruciating. So I went home, my mom, I called my mom, and my mom and I are close, and she knew something was wrong, and she got in the car and drove from Ohio to New York and picked me up and took me home. And it was the beginning of summer. It was 1996, and I sank even further after I got home. It wasn't like I went home and I was like, oh, well, New York was, you know, a bust, whatever. I went home and I thought, I am an absolute failure at life. I've done everything they told me to do. I got good grades. I went to college. I went to a good school. I graduated. I got a job, and it was terrible. It was nothing like that, you know, like it was supposed to be. It was really, really, really hard. And if that was the real world, if that was adult life, I was not up for it. And I was suicidal, and I sank and sank and sank. And my parents, you know, this was the mid 1990s, and depression and mental health were not discussed the way they are now. I did not know what was happening. I just thought I was broken. And I thought there was something, you know, deeply, innately wrong with me. And I thought, you know, there's no way I can make it in the world. And so I sank and sank. And finally, my parents got me to a psychiatrist who I met once, and she diagnosed me with depression in a 45-minute session. I never saw her again. And that 45 minutes changed my whole life, because she wanted to put me on medication. And I'd never known anybody who'd gone on medication for mental illness. I'd never heard of anybody being diagnosed with depression. This was not something people talked about then. And so I just thought, well, I'm crazy. And so then we're getting to the dog. So then, you know, my parents were sort of tiptoeing around me, and I was very hopeless. And I said, sort of out of the blue, to my mother, you know what else I think might help? I think getting a puppy might help. And my mom, ever to her credit, said, okay, great. What do you want to do? And what do you want to get? And I researched, and I decided I wanted a golden retriever. And we went and we looked at one litter, and I didn't really feel connected to any of them. I went and looked at the next litter, and there he was. He walked up to me, he sat down at my feet, and he looked up at me, and it was this, you know, the kind of thing you see in movies. It was this moment of, there you are. I've been waiting for you.
An instant sort of soul connection?
It really was an instant soul connection. And, you know, followed very quickly by getting in the car with him, driving home, he fell asleep on my lap, and me thinking, what did I just do? Oh my God, this is the biggest mistake I've ever made in my life. I can't believe I just adopted a puppy. I can't even get out of bed in the morning. Like, what am I doing? But I remember very vividly just putting both of my hands on his little curled up sleeping body. And those thoughts became less threatening. And in that moment, it was like, well, I've got him now. It's him and I now. And that was really transformative for me. And I got very lucky in that he is, he was a very, very easy puppy. He was like, he had one accident in the house. We spoke each other's language right away. And the training of him was nearly effortless. I currently have a new puppy who is 14 weeks old. First puppy I've had since Bunker. First puppy I've had in 23 years. And I'm like, okay, Bunker was easy. This puppy is not easy. She is a regular average puppy. But the thing with Bunker was that he got me out of bed in the morning. And I knew that he, all these things I had in my head, you know, about I'm worthless. You know, I didn't even notice that I was doing this, that, you know, every little move I made was wrong, that, you know, nobody liked me, that my likability was always really, really in question. And that's still a trigger for me at 46, you know, is do people actually like me? And I knew this dog loved me unconditionally. And that was the little boost I needed for the next 11 years of my life to get back out in the world and to face things and know that if something was hard, I could always go home to bunker and it would be the same. It would be unconditional. It would be love. It would be frolicking outside. It would be active. And, you know, I dedicated my life to him after that. And we were a pair.
So, Julie, what strikes me about your story is, I mean, of course, it's a beautiful dog story because it's really a love story between you and this very special animal. But it also strikes me that, you know, this depression that you had is something that lots of people experience and that lots of people find that it's some other being, I want to say being because it's not always a person, some other being or some other passion that's outside themselves that kind of lets them know, gives them a reason to get up in the morning, as you said it, lets them know that they could be loved, that they're worth something. And for some people, it's an expression of art. And for some people, it's their children or their mate or a friend or the corner grocery guy that's kind to them, whatever it might be. But it strikes me that while Bunker wasn't a cure at all for depression, he was a reason to get some help for the depression, right? He was a reason to live on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because, you know, once I had him, you know, the way that I valued myself was still quite low. I didn't really think I mattered all that much. But my dog really mattered, and he needed to go out and be in the woods, and he needed to get up and have a regular schedule so he understood, you know, what to expect in the day. He needed to have good food. And, you know, as much as I wasn't doing that for myself, I was determined to do that for him because he brought me so much unconditional love and joy. And I became, you know, very protective and proud of him. I taught him so much, and we just could read each other's thoughts. And, you know, when you spend enough time with an animal, one-on-one, I had 3 months to spend with him one-on-one where I didn't have to work. I was at home. I was free during the days, and we spoke each other's language. And you realize that, you know, animals do have this incredible consciousness, and they're wanting to learn and communicate and understand. Once I got to that point, you know, with our relationship, it was like, well, he is me and I'm him, and we are forever bonded. And, you know, now we can do things. And so I, you know, decided to leave Ohio, and I drove cross country with my mom and Bunker in the backseat. And I moved to Seattle and started over at trying to, you know, be a grown up. And with him by my side, I thought, well, maybe I can do it this time. Maybe it'll be a disaster again, but maybe it won't. Maybe it'll be okay. And luckily, Seattle's an extremely dog-friendly, dog-loving place. And so it started well.
The other element, though, that's really present in your story, too, is, and I love how you describe them, a loving but troubled family. Now, your parents evidence themselves in this story not as, oh my gosh, the kind of modern sit down and talk it through parents. They were just sort of, they did the right things. They created a safe space for you. If you said you wanted a dog, that's what they were willing to do anything, to drive from Ohio to New York City to get you, to do those things. So there was extreme love, but they were not mental health savvy, so to speak, and just sort of created a container. And they were a resource, certainly, but they didn't really know how to help you either.
Right.
As is the case with so many families, when you have somebody struggling with a mental health issue, whether it's depression or anxiety or other things, they didn't really know what to do either. It seems like they must have felt pretty helpless.
I know they did. And I also know that they had a lot of, you know, behind closed doors conversations about what's wrong with Julie. And those were heartbreaking for me because I didn't want to be broken. And my family, you know, we, like, you know, it's such a challenging thing, especially to write about, because how do you write about, you know, a family that loves you and is so devoted to you, but also fails you? Like, my mother saved me by coming to New York, but growing up, she also failed me. And as a mother myself now I understand, like, you do your very best, but, you know, we all have blind spots. And in my parents' family, and my mom and dad, you know, my brother, I had an older brother who was, you know, in today's world, unacceptably abusive and really hideous to me, physically, emotionally, mentally, just sadistic. And, you know, I was hospitalized with injuries with his, you know, just beating me up and pushing me against walls. And, you know, his constant barrage of, you know, you suck, everyone hates you, you have no friends, you're stupid, you're ugly. And though that was, I think, the first sort of planting of the seed of I'm not okay. And my parents, you know, they would kind of see it, but they would also be like, oh, sibling rivalry, you know, that's a thing. And that's just what this is. And, you know, they don't get along, but they kind of turned away from it. And instead of turning toward it and trying to figure out what was going on.
Clearly not out of cruelty toward you, but out of either ignorance or unawareness or desperation or defenselessness, whatever, or just they didn't have the capacity to understand what that was. The difference between sibling rivalry, which I've heard is simply caused by having a second child, the difference between those sibling rivalry versus sibling abuse, which is what was happening. And that voice from your older brother that you're worthless, you're ugly, you're stupid is echoed, of course, by then the voice that becomes the voice of your depression. You're ugly, you're stupid, no one loves you.
Yeah.
Bunker didn't have those voices.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, my brother didn't need to be around anymore for me to still carry on his messages. Absolutely.
Well, that stuff gets packaged to go, right?
Exactly. It took me 2 decades of work to figure out that I was doing that. It's very subconscious, this way that we, you know, adopt this way of thinking about ourselves. I didn't even know that that was what I was doing. And so it took me a very long time of, you know, getting out of that and being in a safer place and a safe space where people would, I mean, I cannot tell you how many therapists said to me, this was not okay. This was abuse. This was not normal. And I would just be like, oh, they're so wimpy. Like, therapists are so like woo woo. And can't they all just get a spine? And I really did think that for a long time. And it was partly, and this was, I think, what was ailing my parents a bit, was there is, and maybe it's a Midwestern thing, but there is a definite put your head in the sand and pretend everything's okay kind of thing. Like, if we ignore it, maybe it will go away. That was very often the thing was, you know, I would be very upset and I would go to my room and I would, you know, listen to music or lie in my bed or play with one of the many animals I had in my room as a kid. And I'd come out and I would seem better. And so, you know, people would be like, oh, well, she's better now. She's fine. You know, there was never a curiosity about what was deeper, because there was, a fear that what was deeper would prove that people were not okay and that somebody had made a mistake or that, you know, my parents weren't okay. There was definitely this avoidance, which for me was very, you know, causal in my depression, where I thought, well, nobody can talk to me about how I'm really feeling, which must mean it is taboo and it is very bad and I should not feel this way. And there's definitely something tragically wrong with me. You know, the fact that we didn't talk about it made it that much more toxic for me. So getting to the point where I could actually talk about it required me collapsing entirely.
It seems that sometimes in families, when there's something like this going on, people don't ask questions because in part they don't really want to know the answers, or they don't know what they would do with the answer if they got one.
Yeah.
So it seems like that's the put the head in the sand thing. Like, I know in my big extended family, there was this sort of way of saying things like, if you don't talk about it, it doesn't exist. There's an expression, you know, if you speak it, it makes it so. Right. So if we just don't talk about it, it just isn't. Yes. And that's something that seems present. I'm wondering, Julie, on this side of those events, what do you think people, what do you think are the misunderstandings people have about depression?
Well, I think a lot of people think it's a funk, or it's something you can power your way out of, or it's a weakness of character, or, you know, it's just something you're doing because you're lazy, or you're not being, you know, positive, all that sort of think positive stuff used to drive me crazy, because I literally did not understand that concept. And it was like telling a frog to climb a tree. Well, actually, that's not a good one. It'd be like telling a fish to climb a tree, you know, there. And yeah, and it just, it doesn't, it didn't work for me. And so I think, you know, for me, having taking medication and getting into therapy made me realize that there really truly was something biologically wrong, because the day after I got bunker, I had been on the medication for like 10 days, I think. And that morning that I woke up with him, I woke up and it was the first morning of my 22-year-old life where I woke up and I didn't have this feeling of dread. And the only reason that I knew that I didn't have the dread was because I woke up happy. I woke up feeling like maybe there's possibility, but this was the first day that I woke up thinking, oh, that was actually dread. Do you know what I mean? Like
you didn't know what it was until it was gone.
I just thought it was normal. And then I woke up and I went, wait a minute, maybe this is how the average person wakes up every day. They don't wake up thinking, oh God, no, not another day. Hmm. You know, maybe they don't wake, but it's not that sentence thought in my mind. It's just this gut feeling, this blackness. And it was this morning where I woke up and I felt that had been somehow shifted. And that was when I realized, like, oh my gosh, I've been living under something really, really heavy and dark for a really long time. And I don't know if it's this dog or the medication or both, but today I woke up and it wasn't as bad as it always has been. And that felt like the biggest miracle that had ever occurred in my entire life.
You know what I wonder about, Julie? I've often thought about this. I think it's because depression is one of those words that we use in common everyday vernacular. Oh, I was so depressed about it. Oh, she's depressed. Whatever we speak about it casually, that people don't think of it as a clinical condition. And there's a difference in, oh, I was bummed out about something, or I was sad about something, versus depression, which is clinical and biological. And that we have a false equivalency of those things. Do you experience that as people discuss depression with you?
Well, sometimes, I mean, when somebody says, oh, I'm so depressed about that, I don't hear them saying, oh, I'm clinically depressed. You know, of course, it's not, it is a misused in that way, if you're trying to really sort of be a purist about it. Because the difference, you know, feeling sad about an event or disappointed or in something is nothing compared to, a chronic feeling of depression, and it's crushing. It is really crushing.
Right. And I guess what I was saying is, because it's misused in casual conversation, I think people then think, well, you're sad, so you'll get over it. Or you were bummed out or disappointed, so you'll get over that. And you're depressed, so you'll get over that. Like it's the right. same thing, and it's so right. not.
And it's also, I think, you know, living with somebody who's depressed is extraordinarily challenging. Because you can't get them out of it. You can't do it. You know, they have to figure out a way out themselves, whether it's with medication or therapy or, you know, something that will help them. But it's not, you know, everyone in my family just was like, what is wrong with Julie? And why can't she just get it together?
Well, and then that perpetuates too, because you already felt like there was something wrong with you.
Absolutely.
And it just snowballs. The other part of this, Julie, and part of the reason I really wanted you to be part of this conversation is that while medications helped a lot, while therapy, while a, you know, a family that was doing their best to be supportive, and while this miraculous dog also was there as part of your pit crew to help you out there, that this depression isn't something that you poof got over because you had those resources, that it's an ongoing challenge. Can you say a bit about what you do, what kinds of resources and or activities or thoughts or behaviors that you take part in or use to help the ongoing nature of depression or to help you through that?
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely, you know, it's a lifelong, you know, thing for me. I tell people that I treat it like diabetes, you know, and it's something I make sure I'm okay every day. And when I'm not, I call in various people who are sort of, you know, on call, including my husband, my therapist, you know, my spiritual advisor. I meditate. You know, I make sure that my medication is right. I've had to adjust it many times over the years. And, you know, that it took me a long time to get to the place where, you know, I was willing to tell anybody that I was on medication, that I'd been diagnosed pretty young with this, because, you know, there was a big stigma, you know, especially, you know, 20 years ago, and still a little bit now around this. But I absolutely find that the more open I am about it, the more people are so grateful, because so many of us are struggling, and it's okay. And so I find that what I do now to sort of try to make sure that I'm keeping myself well is I'm just constantly trying to monitor my thoughts. And when I start to, I have done this for so long now that when I start to, my mood starts to turn, I, instead of just going, oh God, everything sucks and I'm stupid and why did I do that? And da, 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 I try to get curious and go, okay, where was the thought where things started to turn? Where, what was it? And is this true? You know, is it true that, you know, everything is terrible because, you know, this happened, or that everything is, this person doesn't understand me because they didn't do the exact right thing. You know, I look back at those thoughts and I go, that's really interesting. Now, is that true? And 99% of the time, it's just my mind trying to protect myself, trying to sort of go to this, you know, place of, well, everything's, it's not okay, and you're not okay, and things aren't okay, and nobody understands, and that's actually not true. And now I don't believe it. Now I can sort of slow myself down. That's a big part of it, just slowing down and trying to get curious about what was the precipitating thought that took me to a place of not feeling okay. And that works wonders for me. And it's, you know, I still struggle. I mean, I definitely have, you know, better times and worse times. But I'm finding that all in all, like, the more work I do and the more I try to be in touch with what is really true for me, I find that the depression has less power over me than it used to, because I'm not buying it, you know? I'm not buying those thoughts that are pulling me down.
Well, Julie, you just said about three things that I want to unpack quickly before we close, because I just don't want to miss them. And one is this notion of getting curious when you have negative voices. And whether or not somebody suffers with clinical depression, we can all suffer with an inner critic or a self-haranguing quality. But this notion of getting curious, because curiosity is not judgmental. You know, curiosity just says, say, what's up? What is that? How come that's happening? So that getting curious, I've never heard it put quite that way. And I think that's worth underlining it. And then the other part of it is that it seems like in writing, there's this expression called the unreliable narrator. You know, if you're reading a story that's written by a character that you don't quite trust, that, you know, maybe it's a character that suffers with confusion or dementia or whatever it might be, that they're unreliable. And your own narrator is unreliable, your own internal narrator of your life. And you, the whole of you, gets to ask it, say, no, that's not how it is. I'm not buying it. I think that's a really kind of amazing thing.
Well, and it's taken a lot of practice over time because, you know, for most of my young life, you know, probably till I was 35, I've bought everything, you know, hook, line, and sinker, that, you know, this was not okay, and that was not okay, and I was wrong, and you know, this whole notion of getting curious about it, you're right, that it doesn't have judgment. You know, you look back at your thoughts, and if you can look at them without going, oh, I shouldn't have thought that, because that's what caused this mood, if you look back at it with this, this saying that, you know, it's not good or bad or right or wrong. It's not any of those things. It just is. So let's just look at it. Let's just get curious about it. What is that? And when you can do that without any self-blame or without any blaming other people, that is when I can find like these little hooks that I catch myself on and go, okay, I got to unhook myself right there and take a deep breath, slow it all down a little bit. And then I can sort of right the ship.
Well, one other last piece, and that is, I think another misnomer about people that struggle with any kind of mental illness, including and especially depression, is that you're an unhappy person, that you have an unhappy life, that you don't experience joy. And in fact, that's not true at all, that you can be a person who struggles with depression, and that I know that you have great joy in your loved ones and your family. Say a little bit about that, if you would.
That's such an interesting question. And I don't know that anybody's ever brought that up, but I really appreciate that because, you know, when I first, you know, was diagnosed and when I first really sort of started writing about and talking about this, people would be like, oh God, how depressing, like a book about depression. Oh God. And actually it's really, it's just a book about the great heights and great depths of the human experience. And one of the things that I was hardwired with, for better or for worse, is that I want to feel it all in its 1,000% truth. And so when something was bad, I felt it really, really deeply. And when something is great, I feel it really, really deeply. And so it's not that I was just this morose Eeyore kind of character walking around and everything was a bummer and everything was sad at all. It is very much that I just feel everything really intensely and deeply. And for me, that's the recipe for a fulfilling life. I mean, I would not want to give up my depression in order to feel less. Do you know what I mean? I feel like because I'm such a sensitive and feeling person, I get to feel the wonder of life that much more deeply. And to learn, you know, how to deal with, you know, the sort of short stick I was handed in my own family scenario, you know, just that I'm not those things that my brother was telling me or that people around me were telling me. That I'm actually okay and maybe even great sometimes, and that you know, I have a lot to contribute to the world and to help people, and you know what else? There are dogs.
Well, and perhaps the dogs, if nothing else, remind us about living in the present and the absence of judgment and the acceptance of all things that are in the moment.
Absolutely. And to greet your loved ones with joy and exuberance, and to go out into the world on even a rainy, blustery day and think, oh, wow, what is this? You know, what wonder.
Well, years ago, and now it's become more ubiquitous, and I've seen it and heard it. It's almost cliche, but that we should strive to become the person that our dog thinks we are. And
yes. So, yes, absolutely.
So, Julie, your book, Dog Medicine, is a beautiful memoir. It's, of course, gorgeously written, but more than that, it's also a story that says the highs and the lows, and that there has been lots of reconciliation in your family, with your brother as well, I understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that you've moved not through this or over it, but you move with it, that that the depression is part of your life, but that you have a beautiful life as well. I'm so glad that you wrote this book. I know that it will provide comfort to many. And more than that, I believe it'll be life-saving. And I'm so proud and happy to share it on the Morning Glory Project. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. What a pleasure.
In reflecting on my conversation with Julie Barton today, there are so many extra blooms in there. The first one that really comes to mind is how she began to learn to talk back to her inner critic, to that voice that told her she was bad and awful and ugly and no one loves her and those kinds of things. And that rather than kind of fighting with that, she chose to ask that voice a question, to approach it with curiosity. Why do you think that? Is that true? And I think that that's a valuable lesson for us all. We all have some form of inner critic, some form of self-criticism or self-recrimination that runs like a tape in our minds. And what a unique idea to view talking to it with, I loved her word, curiosity, rather than fighting against it. That curiosity has no judgment. It's just, wow, what are the facts here? Let's really look at that. For those of us who struggle with either mental health issues or with just a harsh inner critic, that's just a really, really useful exercise and a fabulous extra bloom for today. Here's the other thing that Julie didn't say, but that I'll add on as an extra today. And that is that the inner critic's voice is seldom truthful. It finds one little tiny bit of truth and amplifies it, or it makes up things altogether. That's really different than an inner editor, somebody who says, now, wait a minute, I could have done that better, or I need to do that differently next time. We can grow by self-examination and by not thinking that every single thing we do is marvelous. But when the voice is harsh and critical and cruel, we can almost always identify it as that inner critic voice. And I love Julie's idea of approaching it with curiosity. Her book, Dog Medicine, is one not to be missed. There's all kinds of nuggets in there. Thank you for listening to the Morning Glory Project today. And I hope that if you enjoyed this episode, you'll subscribe and listen to the others as well. I love bringing these inspiring people to you. And I look forward to the next time. Go out and bloom.